Back to the meeting. Yeah, here we go. Yeah, let's do the medicine Buddha. Well, we can do Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra. That's fine.
Oh, that's what I meant. So sorry. I was looking at medicine Buddha, but I meant Shakyamuni Buddha.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we'll do that, we'll do that seven times, and then we'll do the medicine Buddha mantra seven times, and then we'll move into the refuge and bodhicitta prayers. All right. So if you could leave your audio on or not, it's okay. Sorry about the throat clearing. It's probably a nervous tic that I've had my whole life. But like I said, Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Muni Soha. Supposedly that mantra subsumes all of the teachings of the Buddha. So if we were wise enough, we could actually go really deep into this mantra and see the entire Dharma. But I know for one, I'm not that wise, but it plants the seeds, right? So we'll do this seven times. Tayata Om Mune Mune Maha Mune Soha. 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 And then we do the medicine Buddha mantra. And it's pronounced, can you go back a little bit? Yeah, there you go. So it's Tayata Om Bekanze, Bekanze, Maha Bekanze, Bekanze, Raja Samogate Soha. So we'll do that seven times. And it's very, you know, if you can do visualizations with these mantras, it's really cool. For example, if you could imagine the medicine Buddha, who's blue in color, and he's holding a begging bowl in his left hand, that's full of this healing nectar, and that nectar is going to flow out of the bowl and into your body as you say the mantra. His right hand, he's holding like the stem of a medicinal plant, but he's made out of, his color is very sort of a deep blue color, which has some significance. Tayata Om. Oh, wait a minute. Let me go back. Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Rajas Samogate Soha. Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Rajas Samogate Soha. Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Rajas Samogate Soha. Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Rajas Samogate Soha. Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Rajas Samogate Soha. Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Rajas Samogate Soha. Tayata Om Bekanze Bekanze Maha Bekanze Bekanze Raja Samogate Soha. Now we do the refuge in bodhicitta, and remember our motivation is dread of the lower realms, or another way of saying that in ordinary English is that we dread the consequences of living both this and future lifetimes with a mind that's completely out of control and the negative consequences of that. And then we have faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and we also have compassion, and you know, particularly the mind of bodhicitta is a great motivator for doing this. So with those things, those are the main things. So dread of the consequences, faith in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and then compassion, bodhicitta compassion. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness, which is the definition of love, great love. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering, which is the definition of compassion. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And that's great joy. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So that's the great equanimity. And then lastly, the mandala offering. And just offering everything that's good in the universe to the holy beings, requesting the teachings. This ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha filling offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Radna Mandala Kamiyatayami. Last time I looked at last line, Idam Guru Radna Mandala Kamiyatayami. That's translated as, I send forth this jewel mandala to you, precious gurus. Okay, so let's get back and, So, we're going to do start out with a meditation. This is going to be a guided meditation that was in the packet for the teachers, you know, for this class. But this particular nun that I'm quoting here for this meditation, her name is Jeshi Kadra, and maybe you know Nick Rebu. She's the founder of Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive. He was a monk at one time. And before he was a monk, he used to date Yeshe Kadra. And they both, you know, they went to Copan as a couple, and they both became monastics after they met Lama Yeshe many years ago. But she's just an amazing person. So we'll start out with doing a mindfulness of the breathing practice for a few minutes to just settle the mind. So you want to start out with a couple of deep breaths, kind of deep cleansing breaths, and then let your mind connect with the breath wherever it's most obvious to you. It could be the nostrils, just the sensation of, you know, the cool air coming in and the warm air going out, or it could be the rising and falling of the chest or the abdomen. And sometimes it's very helpful to have a little mental note, like a soft whisper in the mind. So when you breathe out, you might say out. And when you breathe in, you say in, just very softly in the mind, just to keep your mind connected to what you're doing. So we'll do this for a few minutes to settle down, and then we'll get started on the actual meditation. So when your mind wanders, and that's the nature of the mind is to wander, you simply bring it back to the sensation of breathing. It's that moment of recognizing that you're distracted. It's like the key moment, like when you become aware or mindful of the fact that you've been distracted, and you bring your mind back to the object of focus. That is the practice. The most important instruction in meditation like this is to simply begin again. Simply begin again. It's that easy. Now, the guided meditation part, I'll describe the visualization. This is a little different than what we usually do, but this is fairly traditional way of meditating on any Lamrim subject, where you imagine that anytime you meditate, you're in the presence of these enlightened beings and universal living beings. So as soon as your mind is calm, visualize in the space in front of you, Shakyamuni Buddha. So, you know, maybe you remember what he looks like. He's got a body his body's completely made of light, like a hologram. He wears the golden robes of a monk. And he has a hair and a top knot on his head. And there's a little smile, just a slight smile on his face. His eyes are slightly open. And he has the all-seeing eyes of wisdom. And he holds a begging bowl in the left hand, and he touches the earth with his right hand, and the earth-touching mudra. And you are familiar with the visualization, but that's the visualization of the Buddha, and he's surrounded by infinite Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all the holy gurus of the various lineages of the teachings of the Dharma. So it's like the Buddha would be like the moon, and all the holy beings would be like the billions of stars around the moon. You could think of it like that. And then filling the space around you, visualize all sentient beings in human form and recall how they've been kind to you numberless times as your mother and in other ways. Visualize rays of light coming from the holy beings flowing into oneself and into all mother sentient beings. So again, we have, in the space in front, we have the Buddha, sort of like the moon, surrounded by all of these holy beings, and like the stars around the moon. And then we're sitting here, and we're surrounded by universal living beings in human form. And then light is coming from the heart of these enlightened beings, these holy gurus, and entering our being, purifying our body, speech, and mind, and granting us the blessings of the Buddhas. So all this light absorbs into you and sentient beings, purifying all negativity and obscurations and bringing all realizations. Make a heartfelt request to be able to realize the essential points of the meditation for the purpose of being able to perfectly benefit all mother sentient beings. So the meditation is going to be on karma, the four laws of karma. And so we're going to imagine, you know, using our, we create, those of you who can creatively align with this, you actually request the enlightened beings to bestow on you the blessings of the realizations of karma and these four characteristics of karma that we emphasized last week. And you can imagine that they grant your request in the form of light and nectar, which once again enters your body. Begin the meditation on the four characteristics of karma. The purpose is to build up our understanding of karma, to recognize the power of karma, and develop enthusiasm to create even the smallest virtue and avoid the slightest non-virtue. The first characteristic of karma is that it's definite. Remember, there were four characteristics. I'm going to say them now, but the first one is karma is definite. The second one is karma is expandable. It increases. The third one is you cannot experience a result without creating a cause. And then the last one is the effects, the results of karma are never lost until those seeds are actually ripened and realized, or they're destroyed if they're positive karma, or they're destroyed if they're negative karma. We have methods to do both. So karma is definite. Think how non-virtuous actions definitely bring unhappiness, and virtuous actions definitely bring happiness. So actions motivated by virtuous mental states, such as loving kindness, generosity, faith, and wisdom, are virtue by nature. Virtuous by nature and can only ripen into experiences of happiness. So these loving kindness, generosity, faith, and wisdom are virtuous by nature. What does that mean? You know, they're not motivated by self-interest. Remember we talked about motivations to keep factoring karma. So any action motivated by non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-ignorance will result in happiness. So, of course, loving kindness, generosity, faith, and wisdom fall into that category. They're not motivated by greed, hatred, or ignorance. Actions motivated by mental states. Yeah. Actions motivated by non-virtuous mental states, such as anger, attachment, and pride, and ignorance, are non-virtuous by nature and can only ripen in suffering and unhappiness. So non-virtuous by nature, anger, attachment, pride, and ignorance are non-virtuous by nature. Again, the key factor here is that, you know, they're motivated by self-cherishing, right? The ego is involved. The egocentricity is involved. So it's always going to result in unhappiness. And remember we said the definition of virtue and non-virtue is based on the result of an action. So if an action brings happiness, it was by nature virtuous. And if an action brings suffering, I'm talking about long-term consequences, not immediate necessarily. And that the long-term consequence of an action is suffering, then that action was non-virtuous. Bring to mind some of the virtuous and some of the non-virtuous actions you've created in the past and think about these in relation to the characteristics of karma being definite. Just to refresh your mind, the 10 non-virtues, remember the 3 of body, 4 of speech, and 3 of mind, and from heaviest to least heavy, so killing and stealing and sexual misconduct are the 3 of body, and lying, slander, harsh and frivolous talk are the 3 of speech, and greed, hatred, and ignorance are the 3 of mind. Of course, there are many more, but that might be helpful. And it's the opposites would be avoiding these. That is virtue, is avoiding these negative actions of body, speech, and mind. And even practicing their opposites. So bring to mind specific things that you might want to purify, let go of, things that still have a bit of a sting when you think about them. And don't forget things that you've done well that have been virtuous. So karma is definite, and if we've created, and mostly, and I'm just some food for thought. But you know, Lama Zopo says this in his Bodhisattva purification practice, that pretty much 24/7 we're creating non-virtue non-stop, because most actions of body, speech, and mind are motivated by self-centeredness, self-cherishing. And so they're going to result in suffering. So if karma is definite and most of our actions have been non-virtuous, then the future consequences don't look good. So this could be a really strong motivator for purification practice if you take this to heart. and to avoid creating the causes for future suffering, and to actively seek out opportunities to practice virtue. Next, karma is expandable and increases. Once the karma has been created and the imprint left on the consciousness, it will continue to increase in strength. This is the nature for both virtuous and non-virtuous karmic actions. So while the action may seem small and unimportant at the time of creating it, because of this characteristic of increasing, it can bring a strong result. Therefore, it is important to be conscientious in creating even small virtuous actions and avoiding even the slightest non-virtue. Through purification, it's possible to weaken the power of non-virtuous actions, but without purification, they will continue to increase. So those non-virtuous actions that we can recall, certainly we don't want to suffer. And so we should be even more motivated by this particular characteristic of karma, that it expands and grows exponentially, to want to purify our minds so we don't have to experience the suffering consequences of non-virtue. And as was stated, to take every opportunity we can to practice virtue, to plant those seeds that will ripen into future happiness. Just little tiny actions, just small kindnesses can bring, ginormous good results in the future. And it's also, we talked about this too, very useful at the end of the day, because karma is expandable, to bring to mind non-virtuous actions on body, speech, and mind that we committed during the day, and do some sort of purification practice right on the spot, at least before you go to sleep, and forget about it, so that karma will not come back to bite you later on. And another example where it might be useful is like whenever you do something that's negative or non-virtuous, is to particularly if it's in relation to another human being, is to try to clean it up as quick as you can. When you realize that you have done something negative or non-virtuous, to try to make it right, to apologize if you can. I mean, sometimes people won't accept apologies. But if you're contrite in your own mind, that's kind of the key thing, is your motivation is clear. I mean, it's compassion for yourself. And it might benefit them, but definitely benefits you to try to clean up your karmic messes as soon as possible. So a little problem doesn't expand into something huge. Third characteristic of karma means that we cannot experience, the result cannot be experienced unless you created the cause. The result cannot be experienced unless you created the cause. So, of course, that's a pretty profound statement, and it's the one law of karma that quite a few people have problem with. The result cannot be experienced unless you have created the cause. But not necessarily the you that you know yourself to be now, right? Not your personality, not even maybe you in this lifetime. But your consciousness is beginningless. We talked about that. It's like a river. It goes, like a river goes through different countries, you know, as it weaves, like the Nile River goes through many, many countries as it weaves its way south through Africa. In the same way, your mind is a stream of consciousness, and it takes on different forms, different bodies in every lifetime. And we plant seeds in every lifetime. And so these seeds can ripen at any time. They can ripen in this lifetime. They can ripen in the immediate next front lifetime or in some distant future lifetime. But most of the karma that we experience in this lifetime was created in former lifetimes. This is what the teachings say. They're not Don Brown making this up. The teachings say this. And so this is not, you know, we don't have to beat ourselves up. This is some very impersonal, karma is kind of an impersonal law, like gravity. You do this, you get that. It's very straightforward that way. So we could not, anything that's been great that's happened to us in our lifetime, it is the consequence, the seeds for this result were planted possibly in this lifetime by us, but more than likely in some former lifetime by some really great being. You know, we don't recognize ourselves as being that being, but that seed is ripening now. And we're experiencing the result of that positive action in some former lifetime by some other, you know, it's still me in the sense of my continuum. That's the point. And then negativity, by the same token, can't experience a result without creating the cause. So if bad things happen to me, you know, I mean, we can go, well, I didn't deserve that, or I didn't do anything to have that. I don't see how that, or that person didn't deserve to be treated that way, or those people shouldn't have happened to them. But that's kind of, that's not really what karma's saying, is it? Karma's saying that it's an impersonal process of the law of causality. It's like a boomerang. You throw it, it comes back. So in a real sense, we are 100% responsible for all the happiness and suffering in our lives. Not, you know, not this personality necessarily, but my continuum, my mental continuum is responsible. The one that I have in this lifetime is responsible for planting the seeds that are ripening into the experience of my life. Good or bad. And in short, we are accountable for everything. And the great news is that if we want to experience really sort of bliss and happiness and joy and freedom, you know, we can't experience a result without creating the causes. So we have to create the causes. If we want those things, we have to plant the seeds. We have to take responsibility for shaping our future if we want it to be different than what it is now. It's very powerful. And then lastly, the fourth characteristic, actions once created will never be lost. The karmic seed is never lost, no matter how long between the creation of the action and the experiencing the result. When the appropriate cooperative conditions coincide, the result will be experienced in this or some future lifetime. So actions once created will never be lost. Those karmic seeds will never disappear unless one or two things happen. We talked about this. One is karmic seeds can be completely purified by powerful purification practice, particularly conjoined with an awareness of emptiness. Only with the awareness of emptiness can we completely uproot these negative karmic seeds. But purification practices can have a great weakening force, can weaken the negativity of a negative seed. So, and we can destroy, of course, our karma with a moment of anger. We talk about how like a bird can like pluck a seed out of the ground. So we had a positive seed that was growing exponentially, and then all of a sudden, big bird comes and just plucks it right out of the ground, and that karma's, you know, destroyed. The positive karma's destroyed, and we've created a whole bunch of new negative karma. But that's how we can destroy. That's an example of how, you know, when we say karma's never lost, in that way, it is lost, because you know we lost the positive karma by a moment of anger. By the same token, we can, as I said, we can purify negative karma. We have, by practicing the four opponent powers that we talked about, remember the power of the resolve, regret, the remedy, and, no, resolve is first, actually. Refuge, regret, the remedy, and resolve. Those are the four opponent powers, and we'll do that meditation later on tonight. So in review, again, karma is definite. So positive actions, this is something really need to meditate on. I mean, think about it. In a deep way, every day, even if you reflect on it for only a moment, because it's such an important, and certainly you need to memorize these four characteristics of karma. Karma is definite. Positive leads to happiness. Negative leads to suffering. Karma is expandable. Tiniest little seed action of body, speech, or mind. Once it's planted, it grows and grows exponentially. And so, taking every opportunity to practice, plant the seeds of virtue, and every opportunity to avoid planting seeds of non-virtue. To actually plant the seeds of virtue. Karma is expandable. Third is we cannot experience the result without creating the cause. Nothing has or will ever happen to us in this lifetime that we did not create the causes for. We individually, we're talking about our mental continuum, right? Not your personality necessarily. Could be you in this lifetime. But as I said, most of the karma that we experience is coming is the ripening of karmic seeds planted in former lifetimes. We can't experience the result without creating the cause. Lastly, karmic seeds are never lost. Now, there's one other aspect of karma that I didn't say explicitly, but when once a karmic seed comes to fruition, it's gone. It's like the flower bloomed and now then it dies. Okay? Can't bloom again. So in a way, experiencing negativities is a way of, particularly if we don't react. If we react to being criticized by criticizing back, just creates more negative karma, right? So in a sense, if we can experience negative karma without reacting, that karma is finished and we can never bring future suffering, can never expand to become even more horrific suffering. So it's never lost. Once the cooperative causes come together, that seed ripens and we experience this result. Unless it's destroyed by anger or purified before it can ripen. By thinking of these four characteristics of karma, our understanding of the power of karma, both virtuous and non-virtuous, becomes clearer. Whatever understanding we have generated by reflecting in this way may hold the mind. The point is, reflecting on this in this way, hold your mind single-pointedly on this for as long as you can. So this is basically whatever you've generated. This is a characteristic of analytical meditation. I mean, analytical meditation it's easy to get distracted even in analytical meditation. So you always, again, the instruction is always to begin again, to bring your mind back to begin again. But in analytical meditation, you do the analysis or reflecting meditation, like in this particular practice, you can do both analysis and reflection. And then when you come to some conclusion that, wow, yeah, this makes sense. Or what if it is this way, you know? Shouldn't I try to align my actions to live in accordance with these laws? Once you reach that conclusion, then you hold on to the feeling that conclusion brings you without any more discursive thinking. And once the feeling begins to dissipate, if you have more time, you can always go back and build the analysis up again. You know, thinking about karma in various and myriad ways to build up a stronger awareness of and commitment to living your life in accordance with these laws. Karma is definite, expandable, can experience a result without creating the cause. Never lost, you know, and you do the analysis again until you generate that feeling again. You hold that feeling single-pointedly without letting, you know, so that it literally merges with your heart and mind by holding on to that awareness and the feeling that goes along with it. Conclude the meditation by recalling the Buddhas in front of you. Visualize that they absorb into the central Buddha, Shakyamuni, like all the stars absorbing into the moon. He absorbs into light, and that light absorbs into you to the crown of your head. Feel that you are one with Buddha in the form of all-encompassing space. Concentrate on this for a moment. Okay, you can relax your concentration. So, anybody recognize this? Has anybody gone? Is everybody muted? Does anybody know what this is?
Boomerang.
Boomerang.
I've got several of these around the house. I gave them to my kids. But anyway, I had one of them framed for a long time because I loved the reminder, the karma, I call it the karmic boomerang. What goes around comes around. There's lots of different ways that people talk about karma. They don't really know all of these sort of, this sort of in-depth Buddhist view of karma, but it really is very simple in that way. What goes around comes around. If you want good stuff to come back and plant good seeds, if we want negative, if we want to suffer more, well, just be mindless and act, you know, act in ways that are not, not skillful, basically. Okay. Any comments or questions?
I have a question, Don.
Sure.
In one of the books that I was reading by Lama Zopa Rinpoche, and just from talking to some of my friends, one of the statements he makes is, my friends that I have met, you know, that if we've met Lama Zopa in this life, that means we would have met him in our previous life. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And so that if I painted a stupa, does that mean that I painted a stupa in my past life?
Probably.
And I painted the throne also.
Yeah, probably.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just thought I had just a very slim chance of actually meeting Lama Zopa Rinpoche. He came to the center, I want to say around 2014 or so,
mm-hmm.
before he went, I guess, to one of the retreats. And it was one of the most beautiful experiences that I could say I have ever had in my whole life. They drove up in a van with his entourage, and they got out like it was like a movie, like Gandhi, and they had an umbrella, and they started over Lama Zopa, and they started throwing all these beautiful rose petals. And it was just the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard. The first time I ever heard Geshe-la spoke, I had slipped into the back of the Gampa, and he was saying a Tibetan prayer. And I thought, I did not know what this Buddhist monk is saying, but it's the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard. And I would just come back just to listen to Geshe-la talk in Tibetan, because it was just something I felt like I had heard before or something.
Well, that's what we call a karmic connection, isn't it? Yeah, we have a karmic connection. So, of course, this is a Buddhist view, and it takes to the degree that you have faith in karma. And again, as we said, I mean, you have to have faith in Buddhism. It's not like, in a way we like to say, well, it's a reasoned faith. And yes, it is a reasoned faith, but things like this, still at the end of the day, belief in, past and future lifetimes, belief that we create everything that we experience. We are the we in the sense of our mental continuum, the creator of our entire existence and our future existence as well. So it's a very powerful notion, karma. And I mean, it's the creative force in our lives. And that's why the Dalai Lama says it's the most important teaching in all of Buddhism. The thing we really, really need to go to know in a practical way. And it also reinforces the importance of just practicing virtue. You know, just making good choices every day, not harming others and so on. By the way, I have to tell this story because I don't know if, let's see, I'm not sure who it was. Last, maybe I shouldn't tell it, but wait, well, I've already started, so I have to now. But so what I was going to say is I taught this class, it's kind of a long rim class, I don't know how many years ago, probably early, you know, I think it was late, around 1990. So that's a long time, isn't it? It was like 30 years ago. I was teaching this class, and I was sitting, we were in the unit, I'll tell you who was there, Joanna Smith and Bill Judge. And Bill Judge and his wife have just moved to western part of the state. Most of you know Patrick, you know, and Joanna. If you come on Wednesdays particularly, you know, I mean, I think Joanna comes on Sundays sometimes. They live in Durham. But anyway, Joanna was there, Bill Judge was there, and it was about 20 people in his class. And we were sitting in the nursery because we didn't have a room and I was renting space, you might say, in the Unitarian Church. We ended up in the nursery with all these, you know, well, anyway, they had all these diaper pails around here. We had to get out of the room, and everybody sat on the floor. And I was teaching this, the subject of you know, karma's definite and karma's expandable. And then when I went, and you can't experience a result without creating the cause, one of the women in the class raised her hand, and she was just very moved, but in a distraught way, by what I'd said. And she said, well, look, when I was a little girl, I got raped by my, you know, by one of my relatives multiple times. And then I've just been in and out of psychotherapy and on medicine. And at this time she was in her late 20s, and she was, you know, she just said, I just don't see how that's, I've got anything to do with that, you know? And she was very, you know, you could tell she still had a lot of resentment and anger, as most people would, because of what had happened to her and how it had literally, I mean, she was married and had children, but and she had a job and everything, but it emotionally and mentally had really been very destructive to her. So the notion that I can't experience the result without creating the cause, I don't know if she was feeling guilty or just angry and not willing to open to the possibility that she was accountable for everything in her life, but not necessarily her personality, that person. But that was a real stumbling block for her. But the story goes on. We're sitting next to her was another woman who was in her mid-20s, and she said, exactly the same thing happened to me. She said her father had sexually abused her. She had gone through all of this angst and stuff about it. It in some way shaped her existence up until the time when she was involved in a self-help program that she went to. I don't know if any of you, I'm not going to mention any names, but anyway, one of the points of this program apparently was that you don't have to understand it, but just creatively align with, you are the creator of your life. You are accountable for everything, and just accept it and embrace that you're the creator of your experience, good or bad, and go forward from there. And she had really embraced that. And when she did, when she was about 18 years old, when she did that class, she said it made all the difference, because she was able to let go of the anger and resentment when she embraced it. She embraced, you know, karma. So I think it's the two point and counterpoint. They were sitting side by side, similar experience. The person who was a victim was in a place where she I mean, and yes, she was a victim. I'm not saying she wasn't a victim. A 5-year-old child who gets raped or sexually abused is a victim. But we're talking from her perspective, not seeing yourself as a victim is very powerful. It allowed the other girl to let go. As soon as she dropped the victim story and said, I'm accountable, somehow that gave her some space to let go, possibly forgive to some whatever degree she could. Whereas this other lady was very resentful and wouldn't, you know, was not interested in this law of karma anyway. So anyway, it's one of those, you know, moments that I'll never forget, because it really taught me that, you know, the power of accepting and aligning with these particular ways of thinking. Any comments about that? Okay, good. Nothing? Nobody?
Well, hey, I have a comment about that. It goes back to the same question that I had last week that wasn't really answered. I think you answered my question in the same line as what you were just talking about. But my question was, this whole aspect of karma being your own responsibility seems a little bit ridiculous to me in a way. And it never has before until these particular classes. And so it just seems like a closed loop of suffering to me, because if you have bad karma and you're born into a family that mistreats you emotionally or physically, you're in circumstances where your family is poor and turns to a life of crime or what have you, you know, you've got nature and nurture surrounding that child. So their nature may be to be good children, but they have all of this environmental influence and they become bad and they start creating bad karma, which leads them to the next life of more bad karma. And it just seems like a very cruel situation that somebody can't ever get out of this loop.
That is such a great point. It's a great point. That's called samsara, by the way. And that's exactly what the Buddha was saying. That as long as our actions are motivated by ignorance, and as long as we continue to be motivated by selfish, self-cherishing, and the actions that follow that we just create more and more suffering. You know, we just create another round of suffering. So have you ever seen the you walk into the center, there's the wheel of life, and it starts out with, you know, basically ignorance is the key link that needs to be broken, but it has to do with just what normal life is about and the emotional life of the average person. We just keep creating more and more suffering for ourselves. The key to breaking that circle of suffering is develop wisdom, to develop correct understanding of emptiness, to develop to let go of self-cherishing, selfishness, and start acting in a completely different way. So yeah, I'm just presenting the teachings as I've heard them and understand them. If I've misrepresented them in any way, I'd be happy to talk to anybody later on after the class. But I see karma as sort of a, like I said, like the laws of gravity. It is what it is. These are the teachings.
Well,
and it does take faith. And some people don't have the karma, so to speak, to have faith in karma, which is completely okay. And it's completely okay to not buy it. It really is okay. I mean, I'm not trying to sell anything. I'm just presenting it as an option, as a way to look at life. And I will say this, Lama Zopa, at the end of the first teaching I went to many years ago in Kathmandu, and he taught like for a whole month. We listened to the teachings, we meditated on them, the whole thing for a whole month. It was like 200 people. And at the end of he said, you know, maybe not a word of what I've said is true, but he said, if you live your life as if these teachings are really describing reality, then he was making a bet here. I'll bet you that your life will go better.
Well, I don't have any doubt in what you're saying. It's just struck me in the last these weeks that this particular segment has been being taught that it's very upsetting to think about family members or a huge majority of the population that develop habits of action that are negative, which influences more bad things in the next life, and how do they ever break out of that? I mean, like a huge amount of people in the world, I grew up around violence and alcoholism and murder and all kinds of things, and I feel fortunate that I didn't become part of that environment. I don't know how that happened, but it happened. But there's so many other people that I know that got sucked into substance abuse and all kinds of things that are kind of a disaster, not only in this life, but for their future. And how do they ever break out of that? It just seems like it's just this circle and circle of they won't ever break free.
They have to develop wisdom. I go back to the wheel of life.
How do they do that? Is it the influence of other people, or how do they get the spark of something different?
Can I ask a question?
Well, let me finish this comment, and then you can. the way we break through, we break free of suffering. There's only one way, and that's to develop wisdom. There's no way that's how nirvana, the cessation of suffering, depends upon developing wisdom, the wisdom of emptiness, seeing through the illusion of self, for example. So that is the way to do that. And to do that, you have to be fortunate enough, again, Buddha's perspective, to meet the teachings. But not only to meet the teachings, but be attracted to the teachings. And then be attracted to the teachings enough that you're willing to put the time and effort into actually putting them into practice and deepening your understanding. And this can take a whole lifetime. But that is, from the Buddhist perspective, the way to get free. That's called freedom. It's called nirvana, the cessation of our suffering. And there is the Buddhists claim there's a way out. That's the great news. They're painting, maybe the picture looks tough, looks dismal, and it does, as long as our mind is motivated by self-cherishing, selfish ignorance and the actions that follow. There's no way out. And even those of us that think we have it good, you know, if we really understand the nature of dukkha, and we haven't, that's in a whole nother teaching in another module, but everybody suffers all the time. We're constantly never satisfied, always looking for more, blah, blah, blah. It just goes on and on. And so there's gross suffering and there's a lot of subtle suffering, not so obvious, going on all the time. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was wanting to say something, if I may.
Wait a minute. Carmen was getting ready to.
Oh, okay.
Carmen was up next. Go ahead, Carmen.
Can you listen to me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I grew up in Lima, Peru in the 80s, and we had terrorism there. And I have met people, you know, who actually were very poor. And yet these people were so humble. And that it is a choice. And some people were actually happy, you know, we make a decision. Actually, I was more privileged than a lot of people. And I went to the Catholic school, and thanks to the commandments, there was one that said, no killing, you know. And so I remember being this angry person who wanted to change the society too. So I did actually understand the terrorists. I said, oh my God, I think they are right in a way. You know, they are right. They have the right to try and be rebellious and change things because we are starving here. Things are not just. This is not just. And I want justice. But then something just clicked on me and said, but killing, because they started bombing, right? This is not right. So that stopped me from probably joining these terrorists. And there's been young women and who have actually joined these groups because they didn't have what I had, which was all these teachers and educators. And I don't know, but there is a choice. So no matter how good or bad your life is, you have to look at others. I just look at others. I remember children in the streets at night, no food, all this. It was just so much suffering, unbearable suffering. And I said, oh my God, what do I do? I have to save myself. That's all I can do. I'm a teenager. I cannot help anybody. But there was a choice. At least I made a good choice. I got out of Peru. And because I was lucky to come to America. But it's a choice. And I think people choose to be good or bad, or it has nothing to do with privilege, because Americans suffer a lot today. You know, Americans take drugs and alcohol and all that. And they don't even know how much they affect us by buying drugs. They are causing all the violence we suffer in Latin America. I never did drugs. I was against drugs. So, yeah, we have the choice. It's in our hands.
Yeah. So it's something, you know, again, it's a, you know, the notion that we're responsible, accountable.
Yes.
For our lives. And, I mean, you could see that as a bad thing. Like, oh, my gosh, that means I'm guilty or bad because look at the bad things that I've done or the bad things that have happened to me. And or we can see it as a real opportunity and a real opportunity to create our future, because if we can't experience the result without creating the cause, then let's get busy creating the causes for happiness, you know, for nirvana, for enlightenment, or at least having a better day.
Yes.
So yeah, it's a choice. And I'm sorry, who's? Thank you for that, Carmen. I appreciate it.
Sharon. Yeah, that was touching. It was me. I was just going to address Kelly's question, because I've pondered the same thing, like particularly even with animals, you know, like say we get a rebirth as an animal, how on earth are we ever going to find the Dharma again, right, for a better rebirth? And the thing that has struck me there, or that I try to remember, is, you know, we're talking about eons of lifetimes. Like, you know, I've probably had, you know, infinite lives just to get to this point. And, you know, and all the prayers that we say, you know, for the, you know, all sentient beings. So, you know, and then talking about karma, this kind of brings up a question that I've had, because I'm confused. You know, every single day, say, you know, I'm throwing good karma and I'm throwing bad karma, and it's all going to ripen eventually, right? But like, in what order? And so maybe, you know, someone that's suffering in this life, you know, like the children that are
you know, being abused and, you know, bad, you know, maybe that bad karma then is going to be ripened in the next life. Some of their good karma will ripen and they'll meet the Dharma. So I know I jumbled up a bunch, but that's kind of my thoughts on what Kelly was saying that, you know, helps me a little bit when I feel bad for all beings that are suffering.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a good example. Maybe this will address the issue you brought up, Kelly, is that, for example, you think of some, I mean, Buddhism has hell realms and different realms of existence, and you go, well, how does somebody who's in hell ever get out of that? You could think of hell realms here on this planet, right here in our town, in our community. How does somebody in a very destitute situation ever get out of that? Well, the story in the hell realms, in the Buddhist texts, they talk about how when you, if you've spent like 100 countless eons in the hell realms and the karma finishes for you to be in hell and then a karmic seed ripens for you to be a human, you could go from hell to being a human because that karma's finished. And so it is kind of a random thing. I mean, we don't have any idea what karmas are going to ripen today, tomorrow, next week. I mean, the karma for us to be dead, certainly it's in our continuum now for us to die in this lifetime. We don't know if it'll be tonight, tomorrow, or 10 or 20 or 30 years from now. We don't know. So, but these karmic seeds they're just there. And, when the cooperative causes, like for example, you know, like you mentioned throwing karma. So there's completing karma and there's throwing karma. And completing karma has to have three actions. A complete karmic action can actually project us into a whole new lifetime. And that, for that to occur, there has to be, you know, your motivation. There has to be an object and an action and then, you know, rejoicing in the action. Okay, so you can imagine that if you kill somebody and you rejoice in it, ooh, that's a complete karmic action that could project you in a hellacious existence for a very, very long time. Whereas an act of kindness, by the same token, could be the karmic seed that will ripen in a human rebirth. So that they call it throwing karma. It can throw an entire type of existence. Okay? So that's a complete karmic action. These actions that don't have all of those different factors, but we're constantly creating this what's called completing karma. So it's making up the details of our lives. Sort of like you make a sketch of a human being, right? That would be the throwing karma. And then you fill in the details of the sketch. You know, the color of the hair, what the face looks like, you know, every detail of that person. That's the completing karma. So karma is an explanation, whether we accept it or whether you accept it or not. It's an explanation for everything that could possibly happen in our lives. It explains it. And it has a logical explanation. But again, it takes faith. And I think it, in some ways, it takes time. It takes, I think, living our lives in accordance with the laws of karma as much as we can. And if we start seeing some benefit, then we really have faith in karma. But that takes practice. Anything else?
Don, Kelly was talking about earlier about all this horrific things that happen to small children, be they female or male. Is it that bad things that happen, isn't that burning up karma?
Yeah.
Also, like for
that's what I'm saying. Even like in the hell realms, when you're karma is finished, when that karma to be in hell is finished, then the opportunity for a karmic seed that was planted 50 lifetimes ago, or maybe even in this lifetime, for this opportunity for this other karmic seed to ripen, which could bring about a whole new outcome, a good one, a beneficial one. So we're not stuck in hell forever. You know, that karma will finish. And then maybe a better karma might ripen. It might not be a great new karma, but it'll be a little better. So, you know, but it's random. It's really random. That's disappointing to me too, but it is, that's the way the teachings describe it.
Anthony, you had your hand up. Do you still have a question?
I was just going to make the comment that, you know, for me, it's really helpful to also remember karma in the context of dependent origination, which is really stating that all things happen for reasons. Like there is a direct relationship. And so things don't just happen randomly. And if you look at that from an empowering point of view, that means we have the power to change things, to change ourselves, to change our karma, be it through purification or through abstaining from acting in certain ways. It doesn't change the fact that horrible things happen and that they should be looked upon in negative lights, but it does give us the power to change things. And even more, I mean, in me personally, it kind of helps empower and generate and make manifest the idea of bodhicitta. I see that suffering's occurring, and I know that I am not capable of stopping all the suffering on this planet, let alone mine half the time. If I were to make it to full Buddhahood, I would develop omniscience, and thereby I could become the causes and conditions for hopefully making a lot of other beings that are suffering go to the enlightened state. And karma isn't a negative thing, although negative consequences can happen because of it. It's truly, to me, a sense of empowerment and gives not only personal responsibility, but also the ability to really change what I experience. I can't change what happens to me, least of all from karma that's already been generated either in this lifetime or prior lifetimes, but I can change how I can react to it. And that's why you see two people that are brought up in similar situations. Maybe they're both abused by their parents and one goes on to abuse their children. The other person decides that this is where it ends, that they actually want to, you know, be an advocate for children that are being abused and go and do great things with their lives and help a lot of people. Like, we don't decide what happens to us, but we do decide how we react to it. And karma is just a tool that is neutral, that helps us understand the framework so that we can explain the causal nexus. But yeah, that's all I wanted to say.
It reminds me of something we talked about in the first class. It seems like, I mean, there are different ways to see worldly. There's your life. It's like, you know, either everything's random and there's no lawful, you know, there are no laws. There may be there are other ways to see it too, but, you know, I think for most of us, most people, you know, you hear a lot of people say, well, I'm spiritual but not religious. I don't have any particular beliefs or whatever. But, you know, if everything is random, well, that's kind of a dismal situation. Whereas if God is the cause of everything, well, then we're, again, you know, we're not God, I don't think. And, you know, so, again, we're not really in the driver's seat. Whereas karma, the laws of which Buddhism would say the laws of nature, they are how things are. That actually explains everything, you know, and it puts us in the driver's seat for our future. Not only, you know, in a way, understanding what happened to us, and it might be useful to go back and, you know, if bad things were happening to us, and we know the karmic causes of it, and we're going to talk about specific negative actions and the karmic consequences and how to, you know, do the, you know, create the causes for happiness and so forth next week, but be more specific about the different negativities. But, you know, it's, yeah, I better shut up. I think I've said enough. Anything else?
So, yeah, so this is Kelly. I appreciate all of the different comments. It gives me something to think about. I, like all of us here, are fortunate in that I'm attracted to this information and I'm learning it. But I think what has thrown me off the cliff is the people that I care about that have experienced and continue to experience things that aren't good, that it just creates, you know, suffering in their future. And it's hard to stomach that that's, it seems cruel. And I've always thought of Buddhism as being compassionate. And this idea just suddenly occurs to me in the past weeks that this is just cruel. Mm-hmm. But I'll think about what everybody had to say and maybe try to get my brain around it.
Well, I'll just one thing when you say that. When you say it's cruel, what is who's doling out the cruelness?
Well, I guess it's the law, so to speak. The law of it is cruel.
Pardon?
The law of it, the fact of it. I don't think there's a person that's doling it out, other than, like you say, it's the individual reaping what they sow.
Yes.
But if they don't understand that that's what they're doing, that's cruel.
Well, you know, again, I've been trying to communicate that this is an impersonal process. You would never say gravity's cruel, right?
Right.
So if you jump off a building and you die, you wouldn't say, "Oh, gravity's cruel." Right? You wouldn't say that.
Right.
This is gravity. This is just, you do this, the Buddha said, you do this, you get that. Very simple. Very straightforward. It's not personal. And so, it's not personal. And it's a little bit hard because I think we come from a, for example, the word guilt is pretty loaded, you know, in our culture. And I think sometimes we think, that if bad things happen to us, that somehow we are shameful, or we do bad things that we're shameful, and, you know, and it's, we should feel guilty about this or that. And Buddhism is, the Buddhist point of view is when I do something negative, guilt is like self-flagellation. It doesn't change anything. What's powerful, what does change our actions, is regret.
Yeah.
Is regret. So the one of the stories, and this is, we're going to wrap it up here in a second. These three guys they go into a bar and they're drinking the same drink. And one guy takes a drink and he falls over dead. And the second guy, he's just swallowed the same drink that the other guy had had a few minutes earlier. And then he falls over dead. And the third guy has the drink in his mouth. He just took a swig of it and it's in his mouth. And he sees the consequences of that. He's just poisoned himself. And he realizes it. And so he doesn't feel guilty. He feels regret. And he spits it out. And he makes himself throw up. He doesn't want to experience the consequences of it. So when we behave in a harmful way, beating ourselves up and feeling guilty only perpetuates, you know, the problem. But feeling sincere regret is the Buddhist answer for that particular situation. So there's lots here to talk about and think about. So I'm going to post the homework tomorrow. I got slammed at work today and didn't have a chance to breathe until this class. So, so thank you. Let's do the dedication verses now, please. Karen, are you still here?
I am. I'll share the screen now.
We're shooting up the wheel of life, the 12 interdependent links, which is actually a teaching on karma, isn't it? So we'll do this.
Okay.
Yeah. By the way, it's been great class. I really enjoyed the questions and the dialogue and stuff, because this is, I think this is how we learn. In Lama's, in Geshe Gelug's tradition, in the monastic tradition, basically you would go to class, you would hear the teachings, and then you would go outside and debate the teachings for hours and hours and hours until the wee hours of the morning sometime, to try to, you know, really get down to the nitty gritty of what these words mean. And so this is an important aspect of Buddha Dharma, is for us to grapple with the meaning of these words. So I really think this is a great thing. Okay, let's do this together. You can mute it if you want. May all beings everywhere, slain by the sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of motherhood, and no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled, with the mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose body are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find water, may the naked find clothing, the hungry find food, may the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy, may the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests, may all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may these never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid, and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power, and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Amen. So those are long life prayers of Dalai Lama and Khinsa Rinpoche and Lama Zopa, which we often do, but we don't do them in Discovering Buddhism. All right. Well, thank you. And I'll get something posted, get the homework to Karen to post tomorrow. And we'll see you next week.
Thanks, Don.
Happy meditation.
Thank you, Don. Thank you, Karen.